Welcome, everybody, to another fantastic episode of Couch Potato Theater here on the Fandom Podcast Network. Couch Potato Theater is the podcast on the FPN dedicated to covering all those hidden gems, cult classics, and guilty pleasures that are just so good, even though you might have the Criterion Collection or the Deluxe Blu-ray set in your library just mere inches away from your entertainment center. You love what you're watching so much, you don't even care about getting off that couch, even if it's just on cable TV and you come across it. And that, my friends, is the definition of what our show is all about. I am Kyle, and I am your host this week for the most conceivable podcast ever on Couch Potato Theater, as we will be doing as all wish and taking a look at the 1987 film The Princess Bride. However, as always on Couch Potato Theater, I cannot do this alone, and I am very honored to be joined by a couple of amazing guests. First of all, you hear her over on Standard Orbit at Traffic Gam, and you've heard her here on the Fandom Podcast Network on Discoville. She is the Princess Buttercup of the Fandom Podcast Network, Miss Haley Stoddard. How are you, Haley?
I am doing well, and I'm so excited to be here and talk about this movie because I love it. Just absolutely love it, and so I'm so excited.
Yes, yeah, so we've been discussing this for a while, and I know Haley's been bouncing off the walls to get do this one, so this is going to be a lot of fun. But hey, I've got more for you because, you know, her main name may not be Max, but she is our miracle worker. And, you know, she's between her 18 million podcasts, Earl Grey, The Edge, Postcards from the Edge, and her appearances on Discoville, we are excited to have the miracle worker, Miss Amy Nelson, in the house.
Yay, I'm on Couch Potato. This is a first. I'm so glad to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Oh, well, thank you for coming. I can't think of a more fun movie and a couple of fun people to talk about this movie with. But before we get started, let me take care of a little business here. Of course, you're listening to Couch Potato Theater on the Fandom Podcast Network. And let me tell you where you can find this and all the other great shows on the Fandom Podcast Network. You can start with our homepage at fpnet.podbean.com. If you're using your mobile devices, you can find us using the Podbean app. Just search Fandom Podcast Network. Of course, you can also find us on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play for you Android users. Visit our Facebook page at Fandom Podcast Network. You can email us and let us know what you think of what we're doing at fandompodcastnetwork@gmail.com. You can follow us on Instagram at Fandom Podcast Network or on Twitter at FanPod Network. And I am Kyle. You can follow me on Twitter at AKyleW or on Instagram at AKyleFandom. Haley, where can people find you on social media these days and in podcasting realm now?
Yes. So you can find me on Twitter. I am at Trekkie01D. And then you can also find me over on Trek FM Standard Orbit, where I co-host. And I'm also in the Babel Conference, so if you're in there, I'm in there periodically. And occasionally on some other podcasts, but there's been too many. I can't name them all anymore.
Because we podcasters love you, and we have to have you everywhere. But, you know, truthfully, the queen of podcasting, she's probably added about 100 more podcasts just in this time I've been talking about it. Of course, Miss Amy Nelson, and where can we find you on social media and all these podcasts you do?
Well, you can find me on Twitter. I'm at Miss Amy Nelson. I am also on Trek FM. I co-host The Edge, which is Star Trek Discovery. I co-host Earl Grey, which is about The Next Generation, my favorite. I do Postcards from the Edge, sort of a mini show about Star Trek Discovery. So, you know, I like Star Trek Discovery. And you can, you know, listen to me. I'm on Discoville quite a bit. I love being there. So, yeah, that's where you can find me.
Like I said, you can find her everywhere. But you know what? I know Amy especially knows about this because she's got a beautiful Discoville t-shirt she'll sport on occasion. We have our T Public store where you can find all the gear of the Fandom Podcast Network, whether it's shirts, laptop cases, iPhone cases, pillows, tapestries. Kevin is the master of the tapestries around here. But if you visit tpublic.com and search Fandom Podcast Network, you'll come across our store. And of course, the holidays are coming up. You know, what says Merry Christmas better than a Fandom Podcast Network t-shirt?
And that cheap plug there. Discoville shirt is so nice. I love it.
Yes, you wear it well, Amy, you wear it well. And of course, we love to get your input, not only through email, but iTunes reviews. We'd love to get a 5-star review, but you know what? Let us know how we're doing. If it's a 3-star, 1-star, we'll read it on the air. You know, let us know if we're entertaining you or what we need to improve on. So we always greatly appreciate that. But it is time to get down to business because we are here to talk about one of the most cult classic movies I can think of, and maybe one of the most fun movies of all time, and that is the 1987 film The Princess Bride. Now, a couple little facts about The Princess Bride. It was based on the 1973 novel The Princess Bride, written by William Goldman, who was a very big part in the production of the film as well. It was released in the States on September 27th, 1987, with a limited release, and released countrywide on October 9th, 1987. So before we get any further, I have to ask, have either of you ladies read the book?
I haven't. Have you, Amy?
No, and it came out, the book came out in a fabulous year, I might add. So I sort of felt like I was reading the book because, you know, the grandfather's reading it to his grandson. So does that count?
Yeah, there we go. That's what I worry. It's like it was an early Audible book.
That's right.
The film was directed by Rob Reiner. The box office, the budget of the film was about an estimated $16 million. On opening weekend, it made $206,243 on a limited release weekend. It finished with a gross of about $31 million, just a little bit short of that. It had a runtime of about 98 minutes. So let's start with the first time seeing The Princess Bride. I want to start with you ladies. Haley, I'll start with you since you are the princess around here. When was the first time that you saw The Princess Bride? Was it in the theater? Was it on home video?
It was probably on home video. I honestly don't even remember the first time I saw it. I was 5 when it came out, so it's not likely that my parents took me to see it in the theater. But I honestly, looking back on my life, I don't remember a time not seeing it. You know, I'm sure it was probably early 90s when I watched it, but I've always watched it. And it's just one of those, it's always been there. So I don't remember, but I've loved it. I've loved it ever since the first time I saw it, whenever that was.
What about for you, Amy?
Yeah, that's the same thing. I don't remember my first time, but I can't remember a time in my life when I didn't know about Princess Bride, right? So 87, I was definitely middle school, so I know that I've seen it. We definitely had it on VHS, so it was something that I would watch like at sleepovers with my girlfriends. It was just always around. It was such a great movie, so easy to watch, and so many great one-liners and quotable, you know, just those quotes. Everyone knew The Princess Bride, so I can't specifically remember, but I don't remember a time in my life when I didn't know about The Princess Bride.
Yeah, I'm with you. I know I did not see it in the theaters when it came out, and I, you know, it really didn't have that huge box office in the theaters. I did see it when it came out on home video, and I think that's really where this film really took off and kind of got the word of mouth through home video and got kind of its cult status between that and eventually when it started airing on cable, because I want to ask you, ladies, because this movie definitely has a very unique status. I think it's a cult film, but it's just such a beloved film. But I think it was one of those films, it became beloved over time. It wasn't one of those things that hit instantly out there. What do you think about that, Haley?
Yeah, I can definitely see that. I think that I think the love for it has grown over time. And it's just something where, like, I showed it to my daughter 2 years ago, and she loves it. And sometimes I'll come out and she's watching it all on her own. And so I think, you know, it's just one of those, it was a slow burn and then it just caught fire. And now it's just, you can't imagine your life without it.
Yeah, it's one of those films. It's just like, what, you haven't seen The Princess Bride? So you grab the person and sit them right down. What are your thoughts on this, Amy? Because like I said, I almost kind of feel like it. I mean, the home video was a big thing, but I really think it's constant play on cable, because there was a time when it was like, felt like it was on every week on either like a TBS or a USA Network or something like that.
Well, I didn't get cable until I was a very much older adult, so I wouldn't know that. It's just, we had it. So my parents are divorced, so we had a copy at my dad's house and at my mom's house. So it was very much available to me. But what I find interesting about this movie is that it's not your typical movie of the 80s. Like, we have this narration. It's sort of like an A plot and a B plot, because you have the kid going through the book, and that's sort of the B plot, but it starts out at the beginning and then it switches to the actual story of the book. And stories and movies weren't told that way. It was, you know, here's a movie, bam, 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 bam. And this one, you're going back and forth between the reality of the kid who's homesick with his grandfather reading to him and the imagination, the story part of it, that's the entertaining part. And so this going back and forth is so relatable, I think, to so many of us who were home at sick and not really sick, you know? And then like, ooh, grandpa, they're kissing, and ooh, skip that part. Wait, what were they doing? You know, it's like you're trying to be cool as a kid, but you really want to know everything. And I think that that's what made this movie so unique, especially in the 80s, because you just didn't see this going back and forth between the plots.
Yeah, no, I think that was something very interesting and unique for this film, because you didn't see it a lot. And, you know, one of the things we talk about here at the Fandom Podcast Network, especially Kevin and I, is movies that are incredibly quotable. And I think this is easily one of the top three most quotable movies of all time.
Yeah.
I know. No, go ahead, Ailey.
No, I was just going to say, I put out on Twitter the other day, and I just said in my tweet, like, this whole, like, I was going to be talking about something and I had to do podcast homework. And I said it would be inconceivable to not listen to this episode when it drops. And I have friends, and I absolutely love them. They just took it and ran with it. And they're like, oh, are you going to be talking about a movie with kissing in it? And oh my, and it just went on and on. I was dying. I was laughing so hard. Just from one word alone.
I know. Almost every scene, like you could say mostly dead. Everyone knows what you're talking about. You know, well, he's mostly dead. Marriage. I mean, every as you wish. I mean, we could spend all hour just doing these one word or, you know, one phrase quotes, and everyone knows what we're talking about.
Well, all I have to say is, my name is Kyle Wagner. You killed my father. Prepare to die.
Exactly. Like, that is the best.
Yeah.
What's funny is I know Mandy Patinkin has said a day does not go by where he doesn't have at least two people quote that to him.
Oh, I bet.
Oh, I can imagine. Just, yeah.
I was just going to say, what's even crazier, though, is two of the biggest lines in that film that everybody remembers in Inconceivable and As You Wish. You would think they were, like, said constantly throughout the film. Inconceivable was said, I believe, 6 times in the film, and As You Wish was said 7 times in the film.
That is inconceivable. I do not believe that. No. Inconceivable had to have been said 6 times? Are you sure?
Yeah, that's what the count is on Inconceivable.
Oh, my gosh.
That's crazy.
It's just that how it was said was just so amazing. And, you know, what's so funny is that the actor who played Vizzini, Sean Wallace, he always felt like he was about to be fired because he didn't feel he was the right casting for it. And yet he is one of the most memorable characters in the film.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So many.
Well, let's talk about the cast here, because what an amazing cast in this film. Of course, let's start with Cary Elwes, who played Wesley. I mean, this guy was cast because of his Errol Flynn look, and I mean, talk about the perfect guy for this kind of film.
Yeah, he did such a great job. I mean, really, he had that innocent look to him at first, and then later on he's Dread Pirate Roberts, and he doesn't look the same, and his attitude is different. It's really well done. Definitely.
Yeah, you're right. When he, you know, is just the little farm boy, and then, yeah, becomes a pirate, and then goes out on this mission to save Princess Buttercup, like, he does. He changes, but yet still remains that innocent, you know, that true love, and it's wonderful. I think, yeah, he, to me, is like Ken of Ken and Barbie. Like that golden flop hair, just so beautiful.
Yeah. And let's skip to real quick to our main villain of this film, Chris Sarandon as Prince Humperdinck. Because, you know, I think a lot of people really only knew Chris Sarandon from Fright Night at that point, when he played in that film. But, you know, he just had that smarmy evil. He just was that really smarmy evil that you just, I can see it as Haley's rolling her eyes over there. She just wanted to slap him silly.
Yeah, a lot. But it works because, you know, you don't think that he has anything to do with her being kidnapped. And he totally does. And then you're just like, and then you can see it and you're like, yeah, no. Oh my gosh. I can see why you're still single. I mean, he acts like, you know, he's tracking her like he would a hawk, as she said. And I'm just like, oh yeah, no woman wants to be with a guy like that.
Yeah. I wonder, how can someone act so convincingly that you are this major egomaniac? Like, he is so egotistical. Everything is about him. And I'm like, how are you acting this? I mean, are you really this way? Of course, I would assume not, but it's so convincing, like smug. And he sells the part absolutely. Complete villain, completely. But yet nice. But yet so egotistical.
Well, yeah. And every good villain needs his henchman. In this case, it's Count Rugen, the six-fingered count, played by one Christopher Guest. One of my all-time favorite scenes with him is when he's about to go down to the pit of misery and torture Wesley, and he's like talking to Prince Humperdinck, "What, you want to come?" And Prince Humperdinck says, "Well, no, I gotta kill my bride, plan her murder, plan a war, all stuff." He was like,
"Blame so and so." Yes,
he's like, "You go rest. Your health is more important." And those two played off each other so well, Amy.
Yes, absolutely. And he was good to go against Inigo, right? Too.
Yes.
No, he ran away.
Well, yeah.
That's what I love. He runs away. He's like standing there, and he's all ready to fight. And Inigo is like gonna go after him, and he's like bolts off down the hall like a chicken. And I'm like, oh yeah, you're just a wimp, aren't you?
Well, you brought it up. Let's talk about Inigo and his crew, because I think these really are the guys more than anybody else that people remember from this movie. And it starts with Mandy Patinkin, who says to this day this is his all-time favorite role, and I can understand why. I mean, these three guys. You had him. You had Well, Sean as Zini, and the late Andre the Giant as Fezzik, who I know stole a lot of people's hearts in this film because of just, he was so lovable. But I mean, these three guys were just amazing in these roles. And I mean, you almost wanted Mandy Patinkin to be the lead in the film more than at times, even more than Wesley, didn't you?
Well, they developed his character and his story much more, I think, than anyone else. Like Fezzik, we don't really know. I mean, he was found, you know, by the Zini. But I think with Inigo, we know his story. You killed my father, prepared to die. And we get the backstory of him, you know, becoming a drunk and then finally, you know, changing his life and going on this quest to, you know, venge his father's death. So I think because his character is developed more, that I think we see and can relate to him and bond with him more. But I didn't know that this was Mandy Patinkin. The long hair just threw me off, and I loved NCI or
Criminal Minds.
Yeah. And so then it's like, oh my gosh, that's Inigo. What are you? So totally blew my mind. There's a couple of others that have blown my mind, but that was one of them because I know Criminal Minds. And then just to see that transformation, crazy, crazy.
What about you, Haley? Because I mean, come on. One of the most classic Hollywood lines of all time.
Yeah. You know what? I love the three of them together. I think they play off so well, and they wrote the characters to play off each other really well, which is just so much fun. And oh gosh, the rhyming on the boat. Oh, I love it.
Anybody want a peanut?
Love it every single time. It just makes me laugh, and oh, it's great. Yeah. It's absolutely great.
Yeah. For me, you talk about Manny Patinkin. I was a big fan of his in the show Chicago Hope. And when I realized the connection there, I was like, wait, what?
See? Yeah. Because it's totally different. It's totally different. Yeah.
I have to talk about Andre the Giant as Fezzik because as a kid, I was a big wrestling fan, so I knew who Andre the Giant was. And when you know about the history of Andre the Giant, you know how sick he was. This was right before he died. He was in immense pain. He actually, there was a scene where he was carrying Robin Wright, and they had to suspend Robin Wright from wires because he physically could not carry her.
Wow.
But he was so loved on set by everybody. Robin Wright always joked, like, on the nights where they would film and be really cold, he would put his hand on her head to keep her head, top of her head warm. And, you know, he just comes across as, you see him in a way, I think, for a lot of people who was that maybe this is their first introduction to him. You just see him as this big, lovable guy that you just want to go up and hug.
Yes, absolutely.
So long as he doesn't have a rock in his hand.
Yeah, no rocks. No rocks in his hand. That is for sure. But let's talk about, too, maybe the role that was one of the most sought-after roles in Hollywood at the time, and that it was the role of the Princess Bride, Princess Buttercup, which eventually went to Robin Wright. And, you know, there's something about her. She is absolutely beautiful, but she doesn't have that, like, stunning take-your-breath-away. You just look at her and go, this is just a beautiful person. It's not this, like, stunning, like, model-type look. She's just got that look to her, and I think it works so perfectly for her in this film.
I think it's great because she's very strong and she emotes that very well. And Buttercup had to be that way, right? I mean, throughout the film, she's got to be this strong person and strong-willed. And so I think Robin Wright was perfect for that just because she emotes that just facially. And I can't imagine anybody else playing Buttercup.
Yeah, this was another one that blew my mind because, you know, when I was young, I didn't care actors who were playing whatever. But now I know who Robin Wright is. I watch House of Cards. Like, that she is, you know, forever in House of Cards. And then she's in Wonder Woman. I'm like, this is an amazing actress. And here she is playing the Princess Bride. So my mind was totally blown. And I agree with you, Haley. Like, she definitely is not your, even though she's sort of played, but like, she's not your damsel in distress. She's making choices. She's living up to her consequences. She is going to marry Prince Humperdinck. That's her choice. And she's going to stand by it, you know, until other things happen. But I love it. You're right. She has this natural beauty that I think you're right is what makes this Princess Bride so endearing. Like, you're right. It's not stunning, like I would say Angelina Jolie, like she is stunning, and Robin Wright gorgeous, but it's like this natural, this deep inner and outer naturalness that's just so beautiful and lends itself to also having that innocence that I think is critical in this movie as well.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. I mean, this was, like I said earlier, this was just brilliant casting. Now, I want to talk, you talked about how you have the A and the B story in this film, Amy. So let's talk about Peter Falk and, of course, a very young Fred Savage.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah.
and real quick, I have to bring this up. I don't know if you guys have seen this or not. They are coming out this Christmas with a PG-13 cut of Deadpool 2. But Fred Savage is reprising his role from The Princess Bride as Deadpool is telling him a story in this cut of Deadpool 2.
No way. Oh my gosh.
I can't even imagine what insanity is going to be involved there, but exactly. I cannot wait for that.
The
thing I loved about this, especially when from Fred Savage, was the fact that they play up how throughout the story, the interruptions and how much he's getting into the story as it's going along. At first, he's like, oh, this is going to have kissing. It's not a video game. It's not, you know, you brought me a book. And then by the end, he's like, no, wait, Humperdinck can't win.
Oh, I love it. I just absolutely love it. And who of us did not have a relative that we did not want to see because they were going to pinch our cheek? I had one.
Yes, me too.
I mean, you know? I love it, though.
My dear, lovely grandma, give me a kiss. Oh, grandma.
But since you brought it up, Amy, what was your feeling on that with the A and the B plot? How well they executed that and managed to kind of intertwine them throughout the movie?
I think it was great. I think the timing was what made this movie just spectacular, because you wouldn't get too far into the book and then we would bounce back to, oh, well, you know, grandpa's got to go home. I'll come back tomorrow. You know, like those, it sort of gave you a chance to, okay, take a breath, you know, because the story is very interesting and it is this, you know, escapade and what's going to happen. And it's like, all right, take a second, breathe, you know, you need your rest. And so I thought it just lend itself, this timing of the movie is perfect and it allows you to recap and think about and then go to the next chapter, if you will. And I love the sort of the underlying story or the underlying moral of the story is that books are entertaining. Like that's what the kid is learning and that's what the grandfather is teaching his grandson, that books are entertaining. It doesn't have to be a video game if you just let your imagination and give the book a chance. And that is a great moral to have.
Absolutely. That was great. But I also want to talk about the two people who most people feel are the scene stealer of this movie. And that is Carol Kane as Valerie and Billy Crystal as Miracle Max.
Yeah.
You know what? You know what, ladies? It's all about true love.
True love.
And seeing Haley smile like as wide as can be right now. So I'm going to let you go first, Haley.
Oh my gosh. I cannot. Oh my gosh. These two. Hey, you get the comedy between Inigo and Vizzini and Fezzik. But oh my gosh, these two are just, oh, every single time. I love it. I love it when she comes out and she's screaming, "Liar! I'm not a witch, I'm your wife." Oh my God, it just gets me every single time. Oh my gosh, they're so good. And Billy Crystal is great and he's so funny anyway. And I know that he really took this role and just, in prep for this, I found an article and like they cut out a lot of stuff but he was just so funny on set. And oh my gosh, they're so fun and so cute and don't even look like themselves either. I mean, the makeup on it was so well done. Oh, it's
yeah.
Amy, well, you're smiling just as wide. So
yeah, Billy Crystal, like this is his heyday, right? And so, you know, seeing him, it doesn't matter the amount of makeup or prosthetics he has. His voice and his delivery is just classic. So Billy Crystal, definitely there for the laughs. But yeah, Carol Kane, she totally won me over. Her comedic timing was spot on. And the connection and the chemistry that they had working together and delivering their lines was so perfect. It was just this, you know, old married couple that hate each other but love each other to the end, you know? Because, oh my gosh, it was perfect. Seriously, yeah. Liar! And, you know, they're, you know, all at each other, but they, you know, they love each other too.
Well, a little trivia for that is director Rob Reiner had to excuse himself from filming those scenes because he couldn't stop laughing during the filming of those scenes.
I believe it.
Yeah.
Because you know the impromptu, like where are the deleted scenes for that? I'd pay money for that.
Oh, that would be so fun.
Yeah. Another one is for all the stunts that Mandy Patinkin did, because him and Carey Ulz did all their own sword fighting.
Oh,
yeah.
He said the only injury he ever had on the set was he hurt or pulled a rib because he was laughing so hard at Billy Crystal.
Yeah.
That's great. Oh, yeah. I just, you know what? It's so fun. I mean, we should all go have fun storming the castle.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's get into a few facts and trivia and see what you ladies know about the Princess Bride, really. So let's start with this fact. Robin Wright and Carey Ulz were so smitten with each other during filming. Their natural chemistry in this movie was amazing. Ulz said he couldn't concentrate on much of anything after the first encounter with Robin. Later, they were so reluctant to end their time with the film that during their final shared scene, the horseback kiss, one or the other of them would keep requesting another take for all sorts of made-up reasons.
I can see that. I can see that. I like that.
They definitely they had some chemistry, Amy.
Wow. Well, yes, you can definitely see it on screen, but that's pretty cool.
Yeah. We talked earlier about Manny Patinkin claiming his only injury sustained during the entire filming of this movie was a bruised rib due to stifling his laughter in scenes with Billy Crystal. His attempt at holding back his laughter is obvious from his facial expression during his line, "This is noble, sir." So it's something to kind of go watch for when you rewatch the movie.
Nice.
Here's one that I found very interesting. There really was a Dread Pirate Roberts. Bartholomew Roberts, also known as Black Bart, who operated in the Caribbean in the early 18th century. He is reckoned by many to have been the most successful pirate of all time.
All right.
Yeah. I mean, how many pirates were there back then? So that makes sense. Fascinating.
So, in order to create the greatest sword fight in modern times, Cary Elwes and Manny Patinkin trained for months with Peter Diamond and Bob Anderson, who between them have been in Olympics, worked on James Bond, Lord of the Rings, Raiders of the Lost Ark, and Star Wars films, as well as coached Errol Flynn and Burt Lancaster. Every spare moment on the set was spent practicing. Eventually, when they showed Rob Reiner the sword fight for the movie, he was underwhelmed and requested at least be 3 minutes longer rather than the current 1 minute. They added steps to the set, watched more swashbuckling movies for inspiration, re-choreographed the scene, and ended up with a 3 minute and 10 second fight, which took the better part of a week to film from all the different angles.
And I love that. I absolutely love that scene. That's like one of my favorites in the film, is that fight scene. Because, I mean, it is so well done, and you can see that they really worked really hard to learn all the moves, but I just love all the lines within it, too.
That's what I was going to say, the banter between them, you know, and it's like, toot, toot, sword, sword, fight, 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 and it's like, well, why are you smiling? Well, I have a secret. You know, it's like, well, I'm not really left-handed. Ba-pum! And they, you know, change to the right hand. And like the banter between them, I think, is just classic. And it really adds to their fighting there. And that's cool to know that they did that and that they had to choreograph it all. And that's kudos to them.
Well, and you talk about that, and you can talk about Cary Elwes and how much of a character change he went through in this film. Showing his range as an actor, as that going from this quiet farm boy to this confident Dread Pirate Roberts to pursuing his true love. And I think that it's one of those things. I always thought he was kind of one of our underrated actors. He's never really had those big breakout roles. He's done a lot of things you see him in, but you've never really seen him carry a franchise or anything like that. But he's so talented.
Yeah, I definitely agree.
But another fun little fact, this is a side thing. Mark Kopfler, who agreed to write the music for this movie on the condition that Rob Reiner, it was on the condition that Rob Reiner put the hat that Reiner wore in This Is Spinal Tap in the movie. The hat appears in the grandson's bedroom.
Oh.
And
that's
how crazy is this?
Request.
He is one of the founding members of Dire Straits.
What?
Yeah. Mark Knopfler was one of the founding members of Dire Straits. Mind blowing. I'm like, oh my gosh. And I love the score in this. It's just great. Like, the music fits so well with the film. And holy moly. It's crazy.
Let's not forget the song Storybook Love was actually nominated for the Oscar that year.
Yeah.
And if I remember correctly, at the Oscars, Prince performed the song.
Oh, wow.
So, the characters of Miracle Max and Valerie, played by Billy Crystal and Carol Kane, respectively, were named after author William Goldman's parents, Max and Valerie.
Aww.
So a little family tribute there.
Yes.
Kind of an interesting thing. Fred Savage never got to meet lead actor Cary Elwes.
Now that just seems so crazy.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, I guess I can see it, but it's like, really? I don't know.
Yeah. That'd be a bummer.
Definitely.
Yeah.
But I guess, you know, when you think about it, he probably wasn't on the set sets that they were on. So
probably
because this movie was filmed on location in England. The castle used for the film was Haddon Hall, a fortified country house, not a castle as such. That dates to before 1087, when it was listed in the Domesday Book. The tapestries in Haddon Hall interiors are original, dating to the late medieval and Renaissance periods.
Wow.
Yeah, I was curious about the filming location. So, and that's probably why Fred Savage never got to meet him, because they did film all over in England and into Ireland and stuff. So it makes sense that a lot of those, he wasn't there. So
yeah,
it makes sense.
And he's just sitting in his bed, so...
Yeah. Now here's a last bit of trivia in here that's I found quite interesting. Although Christopher Guest plays a count in this film, Count Rugen, in real life he's actually a baron. Fifth Baron Hayden Guest of Sailing in Essex in the perigee of the United Kingdom.
That's a lot of names there.
Yeah. They like those names over there.
They do.
Yeah, they do. So I found a few other things I wanted to add really quick.
Absolutely.
So Siskel and Ebert gave this a 2 thumbs up when they reviewed that. Times listed it as one of the best of 87. In 2000, readers of Total Film Magazine voted it 38th greatest comedy of all time. I can see that. And in 2006, the screenplay was selected by the Writers Guild of America as the 84th best screenplay of all time. And then it earned that same ranking again in 2013. So wow. It just goes to show you that this film to this day is still like, I mean, it's got a 97% on Rotten Tomatoes. It's still just, I mean, it's loved.
Yeah, loved.
This is a universally loved film. And props to Haley for dropping the knowledge in the podcast today.
Nice.
But we're going to have a little more. Well, we're going to have a little more fun because we're going to talk a little alternate casting, other actors that were considered or auditioned for this film. William Goldman, the author, has claimed that Carrie Fisher was the ideal choice for Buttercup.
Hmm.
I think a little too strong, but yeah, I can see it.
And unfortunately, I think when you get and Star Trek actors, sometimes, I guess not the new reboot actors, but you know, back in the day, like Carrie Fisher, she was solidified as Princess Leia. It's hard to transition. I mean, so many Trek actors have said that, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're talking, we'd already seen Star Wars. So the fact that Carrie Fisher, I don't know how that would have translated. I don't know.
Yeah. I think she was too well known too. I think that was the nice thing about Robin Wright. She was kind of an unknown still at that time.
Who knew Robin Wright? No one. I mean, I didn't know her.
And you know, I think we would expect a little bit more smarmy from Buttercup if Carrie Fisher had been in the role.
Yeah.
So
I can see that.
So here's another very interesting one. According to William Goldman again, when he was first trying to get the movie made in the 1970s, a then unknown Arnold Schwarzenegger wanted to play Fezzik, and he was strongly being considered because Goldman could never get his first choice, Andre the Giant, to read for the role. By the time the movie was made, about 12 years later, Schwarzenegger was such a big star they could no longer afford him. Andre was cast after all, and the two big men had gone on to become friends.
Oh, that's awesome. I think Schwarzenegger, not, you know, then unknown, could have totally done it. But I love that we have Andre the Giant. I don't think Schwarzenegger's big enough, but I think he could have pulled it off, you know, with the way that they shoot and film and stuff. They would have made him look bigger, but yeah.
Haley, you have like a traumatized look on your face at the moment.
Trying to picture some of the lines like coming from Schwarzenegger's voice, and I just don't think it would have worked. Like, I can't see Schwarzenegger saying, "Anybody want a peanut?"
I need to hear it. We need to call him up and say, "Mr. Arnold, anybody want a peanut?
Get to the chopper."
I don't know.
I mean, Andre has his own, you know.
I mean, he has his own accent.
Yeah.
Like, he does. But I think Schwarzenegger's accent, I mean, over the years, I think it's gotten less. But in the 80s, I mean, I remember some of his early 90s films. He was still really thick on his accent. And I don't know if those lines would have come across as well.
Well, I think would have gotten used to him. We just know Andre the Giant and his lilt and how he says things. I don't know. I'm on board. I would have liked to have seen that one.
Yeah. Okay, so here's an interesting one.
Wait a minute,
one.
Kyle. No. You didn't say. Do you? Would you wanted to have seen Arnold? Are you glad that they got
him? I'm all Andre. I think Andre is perfect in that role. I can't see anybody else in that role. However, Liam Neeson revealed on the Graham Norton Show in an interview in 2007 that he auditioned for the role of Fezzik. Rob Weiner scoffed when he heard that Leeson's height was only 6'4".
What is this? I mean, I like Liam Neeson, but really? No,
he auditioned for it. Wow. I think I see him as too scrawny. I mean, I know Liam, but like, you know, we know Arnold, the bodybuilder. Like, that's an okay fit. And Andre, the size, that's a good fit. But Liam, I mean, yeah, he's tall, but he doesn't have the strength. I mean, can you imagine, like, you know, Gary coming in and running at him? He would be knocked down.
I agree with him. He's not big enough. He wouldn't have that presence that you needed for that character.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Here's an interesting
one.
And I
love Liam Neeson. I think he's great, but just not for this role.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Here's an interesting one for Buttercup. Uma Thurman auditioned for the role. She was deemed too exotic looking for the part.
What? She's blonde? What are you talking exotic? I'm trying to think. Why would they say that about her?
She has that kind of unique look.
Huh. Yeah.
To her.
I'm really glad it went to Robin Wright. Let me just say that.
Yeah. Again, it goes back to what we said. It's the absolutely perfect casting.
Yeah.
So.
Hmm.
Here's an interesting one for the role of Wesley. Christopher Reeve was considered for the role.
Oh, yes.
I could see him in it, but.
I could see him in it.
I just don't know if he could pull off kind of the smarmy.
What?
The cockiness. Because I guess my problem is I always see Christopher Reeve as Superman. I mean, that's one of those things.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yes. And I know I said that about Carrie Fisher, but I want Christopher Reeve in this. Okay. Christopher Reeve has the floppy hair. He could totally pull off the Wesley. It just would be brunette, which is totally fine. And I mean, look at Christopher Reeve playing, you know, the guy. Oh my gosh, brain fart! Playing Superman and who is he when he's not Superman?
I'm a Batman.
Clark
fan,
Kent.
So you're
Clark Kent. Like he plays confident Superman perfectly. He could do it. Okay, I now I'm sad that I know this.
Well, I didn't mean to make you sad.
Oh, man. Well,
okay, one more bizarre one for Fezzik casting. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, the Hall of Fame basketball player, was interested in taking the role but was unable to shoot it because it conflicted with his NBA schedule. No. Just no.
No.
Maybe if we had Mel Brooks writing the film.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I'll go with you on that. That's correct, Haley.
If it was a Mel Brooks version of Princess Bride, maybe that's
Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. Who knew?
Well, let's not forget he has done some Airplane. He did Bruce Lee's Game of Death. So he's been in some films.
Yeah. But
yeah. Still.
Yeah. What did he play himself?
In Airplane he did, not in Game of Death, but. Yeah.
Okay. I'm like playing yourself and playing a character is completely different.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Here are a couple more names, though, finally, before we close out this section. For Princess Buttercup, Courtney Cox.
No.
At that point in time, really, because she's only really coming off of Misfits of Science and the Dancing in the Dark video. So.
No one knew her, right?
Yeah. At that point, Meg Ryan.
She could have pulled it off.
Yeah, I could see that.
Absolutely. Oh my gosh, Kate. Now I want to see Meg Ryan in it too.
Well, you want the Meg Ryan Christopher Reeve special edition cut is what you want.
I don't know if I would want them together. Can I just have one of each?
Yeah, there you go. Okay, and in the most, I think even more insane than Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Whoopi Goldberg openly campaigned for the role of Princess Buttercup.
She did not.
She did.
Oh my God, this is great.
Okay, next time she comes to STLV, I'm asking her this question. This cannot be. She campaigned?
That's what it says. Whoopi Goldberg campaigned for the role of Princess Buttercup.
So we need a Mel Brooks screenplay of The Princess Bride with Kareem Abdul-Jabbar.
Whoopi Goldberg.
And Whoopi Goldberg. Oh my gosh.
Oh, this is like, yeah, blowing my mind. This is too funny. Oh my gosh.
You guys will never see this movie the same. Well, on that note, we got a little promo for you that's talking about all the other great shows here on the Fandom Podcast Network, and we're going to play that for you, and then we're going to be back with everybody's final thoughts on The Princess Bride.
Thank you for listening. We hope you're enjoying this podcast. We'd like to recommend these other great podcasts on the Fandom Podcast Network. It starts with our flagship show, Culture Clash, our weekly pop culture podcast with the latest news, reviews, and other fun topics in pop culture. Also, Blood of Kings, a Highlander podcast where we discuss all things Highlander. Couch Potato Theater, our podcast celebrating the cult classic and fan favorite movies we don't get off the couch for. Time Warp, a look back on our classic and nostalgic fandoms that we still celebrate today. The End Zone, our podcast talking about all things current in the NFL and giving our best mediocre fantasy football advice. Good Evening, an Alfred Hitchcock podcast. Discoville, a Star Trek Discovery and the Orville podcast. The Hair Metal podcast, if you're a hard rock music fan, the Hair Metal podcast rediscovers the nostalgia of the 1980s hair metal bands. And Type 40, a Doctor Who podcast, as we discuss all things Doctor Who, past and present. You can find these great shows on the Fandom Podcast Master Feed at fpnet.podbean.com. The Fandom Podcast Network is on iTunes, Stitcher, Podbean, Google Play. On Facebook, you can find us at Fandom Podcast Network. On Instagram, we are at Fandom Podcast Network. And on Twitter, at FanPod Network. You can also email us directly at fandompodcastnetwork@gmail.com. Thank you so much for listening and support the Fandom Podcast Network. And remember, respect others and enjoy your fandom.
Well, first of all, this has been an absolutely fun and entertaining podcast doing this with you ladies. So I can't thank you enough for being here, because we are talking about such a fun and amazing film. But I want to give each of you a chance to kind of sum up what The Princess Bride means to you and where it ranks for you in importance and in your fandom. So, Haley, you're the princess. Let's start with you.
Yeah, you know, like I said, I shared this movie with my daughter a couple years ago for the first time. I felt she was kind of getting to that age where she could appreciate these films. And I can see that it's always going to be there in her life, just like it's always been there in mine. It's one of those films that I can put on and I don't even have to watch it anymore, because I can see it playing out in my head and I can say lines along with the film. And it's just one of those movies where if you need just a good movie to watch, just not anything in particular, I will put it on and it just makes me feel good, because I remember watching it when I was a kid and it's so memorable and I just absolutely love it. There's so much to it. It's got such a great storyline. It's absolutely beautiful in my opinion. And if you haven't watched it, what is wrong with you?
Yeah, I can echo that. What about you, Amy?
I think that this movie, like I said, I just can't remember a time in my life where I didn't know it. And I was just thinking about, literally, we could go back and forth. We could just do one right after another and keep on going with all these one-liners and the phrases that are in our cultural vocabulary. The writing on this is spectacular. it's so lighthearted, but has such good morals to it about what is true love and sacrifice and what you're going to do and vengeance. And like, it has everything that a story should have. It's got great acting, and it just came out in a time in my life, like that middle school years where it's awkward. And so you can sort of relate to, you know, Fred Savage's character of, you know, trying to be cool, but still a little kid. Like, it just, that movie was made for me. I feel like it just encapsulates my youth, and it's very interesting. I'm a school teacher, and every once in a while I'll say these phrases and some of the kids know it because they also have watched it. And I love, love, love that. I love Princess Bride for so many reasons, but those are just a few. So yes, it's a wonderful, wonderful movie.
Yeah. For me, I think The Princess Bride is one of the all-time anybody can watch this movie and not be ashamed that they love this movie, whether you're the most macho of macho Navy SEAL guy or whatever, or the quiet librarian or whatever. This is a movie for everybody. There is something in this movie for everybody. And what makes this movie even more magical, it is a complete family film. There's not anything in there that you would be afraid to show your child. You would want them to be there, and you all enjoy it, and you all pull something else away from it. This is easily one of the most magical films of my lifetime. You know, you talk about like Wizard of Oz for generations. I think this movie, for especially for people in the 80s and in the 90s, and even now, this movie translates across the board. I watched this before we did this podcast. Outside of maybe the oversized rat effect, everything in this movie holds up. There is not anything in this movie that doesn't hold up. Except maybe the stuntmen who fell down the hill. They might not be that much anymore. But this is I have a pantheon of movies that I think are perfect, and this is one of those films that's just, there's nothing wrong with this film. This film is perfect from the start to the finish. What from casting to the moments to the quotable lines to the seriousness at times to the adventure, everything. It hits every note perfectly. And, you know, it's that is why I think is one of the greatest couch potato theater movies of all time, because it's one of those movies you're just flipping through your cable channels or your TV and The Princess Bride is on, you just stop. And you more than likely you're going to end up watching it the whole way through. So with that, you know, it's been an amazing time. Thank you so much, ladies, for joining me on this edition of Couch Potato Theater for this amazing film. It's been an honor. And you know what? We never know what's coming next on the couch, but we're going to have another cult classic for you. So until then, we will see you next time on the couch.